Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by the boss, John Rurink, Jack Spencer, and with Public Policy Associates CEO Sam Singh is joining us first here on the podcast. Good morning, Sam.
Good morning, Kyle. Thanks for having me back on the podcast.
All right. So our viewers can't see this, but I am wearing right now a vintage 1995 Sam Singh for East Lansing City Council shirt that I found up in the archives. And Sam, I think you've got a couple of these somewhere, don't you?
I'm sure they're somewhere in the closet, along with some state rep shirts and things like that. But yeah, that shirt was from 1995, a year after I graduated from MSU, and I was running for city council. And luckily, we won that spot. So,
don't you wish you were back? I mean, considering all kind of the tumult that's going on right there, you ran with Mark Meadows back then, and he left the council. Don't you wish you were back helping things out?
Well, I often joke that, you know, as soon as Mark Meadows leaves somewhere, I usually go there and then I clean up the mess. You know, he was mayor of East Lansing, and then when he left to the legislature, I became mayor in East Lansing. When he left the legislature, I became a legislator. And so when he decided to resign from city council and as mayor, you know, I was asked, you know, would I put my name forward for a couple of the appointments for those open seats? But I declined. I think, you know, I did my time with the city of East Lansing. They got two great new council members that'll take the city in the right direction. And but, yeah, I've often followed in the footsteps of my friend Mark Meadows.
I wanted to have you on because I wanted to have you talk, first of all, about the Joe Biden selection of Kamala Harris. I know it's been a couple weeks now, but the talk is centered more around the fact that she's the first African-American female who's running for vice president, but she's also Indian-American. And I know that's something that you've taken a lot of pride in here.
That's right. You know, her mother is was Indian-American, immigrated to this country. The story is very similar to, you know, stories of a lot of Indian Americans throughout this country. Our parents came over in the 50s and 60s to find a better opportunity. And, you know, when you talk and hear from Kamala Harris, you hear those roots come out. I know for most of the country, they view her as, you know, a Black candidate for vice president, but she also has that tie to the Asian Indian community. There's a lot of pride. I talked to my mother and some of my parents' friends, and there's a lot of pride that somebody from an Indian background is not only involved in politics, but now is a vice presidential candidate. And I was a supporter of her for president for a number of reasons, but also I followed her because of her Indian American roots. And I was disappointed when she dropped out. I was planning on going to Iowa. I still did go to Iowa. I was hoping to volunteer for her campaign, but you know, I was pleased to see as the election sort of went forward, as Vice President Biden became the nominee, it was clear that, you know, Kamala Harris could be a nice complement to him and bring a lot to the ticket. So, yeah, not only as an American am I excited, but also as somebody with Indian American roots, I'm really excited that somebody from our background is part of the national ticket.
John?
Hey, Sam, I wanted to ask you if you could talk to us a little bit about your work at Public Policy Associates. How has it changed since COVID-19? Are you working on anything exciting and new?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think like most businesses, you know, we've been remote since, you know, a week before the stay-at-home orders in March. All of our clients have, you know, had to really retool how they look at public policy issues that are facing their organizations. But over the last few months, we've picked up a number of clients, mostly in the state government space, but also in philanthropy. We're all trying to get a better understanding of what COVID-19 means to the long-term implications. We're doing some work right now with MSHDA. You know, obviously, they are taking a look at not only some long-term strategic planning as an institution within state government, but also trying to figure out how they can best help Michiganders handle the impact of COVID-19. A lot of that is around, you know, eviction, so making sure that we're not throwing people out in the streets during this very difficult time. And so we're helping them think through some of their programs. But one of the interesting things that I've found, especially with our philanthropic clients, is that as we've been looking at a variety of COVID-19 issues, a lot of it ends up going back to racial inequality and issues around equity. When we've been taking a look, whether it's on the healthcare side or even on economic prosperity, we're just seeing some huge divides there. You probably saw one of the national groups, the National Bureau of Economic Research, came forward and said right now 40% of Black-owned businesses have shuttered down because of COVID-19, and just compare that to only 17% of white-owned businesses. And so not only are there issues that are facing the African-American community and the Hispanic community and indigenous populations in the healthcare, which we read and see a lot about, we're also seeing it in the business sector as well. And so as we're doing some of our research and work with these groups, we're trying to get to the bottom of that and get these foundations to figure out how they can be most helpful and supportive over the months to come.
I have a question on the evictions. Does that include, when you look into that, the problem of the people who are renting? Because they're still paying the bills for the heating, et cetera, et cetera. You can't just say you can't evict. You have to actually worry about the fact that somebody's taking it on the chin, and maybe they're going to run out of money if they're the ones that are renting. Is that part of the picture?
Yeah, absolutely. It's not only just homeowners that we're looking at. It's also renters. You bring up a big point. It's not just only the renting of the house, right? It's the utility costs that somebody has, whether it's water or electricity, especially as we go into the winter months when, you know, you've got some of the highest heating bills that will be coming forward. It's trying to help people think through some of that. And there's no easy solutions. You know, you can put moratoriums on, which have been done, and that's effective for the short-term solution. But again, if people aren't working, they don't have access to resources, we need to help them think through how to manage some of those issues. But yes, it's not only for homeowners, it's definitely for those that are renting. And often those that are renting are in more of a precarious situation because they haven't had the resources to actually purchase a home. So there's a lot of conversations happening about how there's rental assistance that can be provided, utility assistance that can be provided, and working closely with local governments, but also state government. And one would hope that federal government would look at more resources coming forward. Obviously, a good surge of revenue came in that March-April timeframe during a former stimulus package. But the fact that we haven't seen anything coming from Congress or the president and somewhat of a deal to come forward has been really disappointing. And that is going to be what is on everyone's mind over the next couple of months is, will there be another deal that can actually infuse resources back into local communities to help people, especially those that are in the lower income of our state?
Sam, I wanted to have you put on your hat as prognosticator here. Obviously, you were very instrumental in the House Democratic Caucus, and you were there, floor leader and leader. What do you think their chances are going into 2020 here of them taking the majority? Would you give it 50-50 odds or better?
Yeah, I'd give it a little better than 50-50 odds. You know, when we were there back in 2018, we thought it would be a two-year cycle. We picked up five seats in 18. The number of seats that we didn't pick up in that period of time were dealt with three-term incumbents. They were finishing up their last ability to run. And so there's now open seats that weren't there in 2018. And so I think there's a good opportunity. If you look at the national polling and the Michigan polling, it looks like Michigan is moving in the right direction for Democrats. We saw that in 18. And if those numbers stay at the same level as they did in 18, where you saw the surge, especially in Oakland County, you could see anywhere from 2 to 4 seats flip in Oakland County. And if four flip, that's the majority right there. Now, obviously, there's other great places for Democrats, whether that's Traverse City, over in Kalamazoo County, the Portage area. There's some stuff up north over in Midland and Mount Pleasant that people will look at. So there's a lot of opportunities. But at the same time, you know, Democrats have to make sure they have a tight message. They have to win those seats and they can't go backwards. And I'm sure the Republicans will target a lot of those seats that were picked up in the 2018 cycle and put a lot of resources there. So it's a tight line that they have to cross. But at the same time, when you look at some of the polling that's happening in Michigan, it's all headed in the right direction.
All right, Sam, give me a number then. The Democrats on January 1 are going to swear in how many members? 60? Will you go as far as 60?
I wouldn't go that far. I would love, as a Democrat and former Democratic leader, to see that. I'm saying it's going to be somewhere in that 56, 57 range. But 60 would be a huge wave that would, you know, have implications for years to come, especially down ticket when you're looking at county races and different township races and things like that. But I think 56, 57 would be in the range if everything progresses the way the polling is showing right now. Is where we'll end up in January 1st. Now, if things tighten up, which we've seen happen over the last couple election cycles, it might be tighter there. But right now, it's looking like it's targeting towards a slim majority for the Democrats.
All right. Sam Singh, CEO of Public Policy Associates. Thanks for jumping on with us and taking a trip down memory lane here a little bit with the city council. Thanks a lot.
Great. Thank you very much. I enjoyed being on.
We'll get started here. Elizabeth Welsh, she is the Democratic nominee for Supreme Court. And John, why don't you go ahead and start things off?
Well, I want to start with, it's always interesting to cover Supreme Court races because they're not always that closely paid attention to by voters. And now with the pandemic, I would think it would make it even more difficult. What are your thoughts about running for the Supreme Court in this unusual year?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, as I've talked to voters across the state, I kicked my campaign off in December and was putting 1,200 miles a week on my car pre-pandemic to reach as many people as possible, which I'm glad I got 3.5 months under my belt before obviously everything changed dramatically. But you're exactly right. As I remind people all the time, we have three branches of government and you have seven justices sitting at the top of the third branch. And the vast majority of voters can't name a single Supreme Court justice, frankly, in any state in the United States. This isn't unique to Michigan. You get a group that obviously pays attention to the U.S. Supreme Court, but people fail to realize that 95% of cases are filed in state courts and that, in fact, their state Supreme Court dramatically can impact their lives. So we are doing everything we can to bring attention to the race. We spend a lot of time on Zoom this week leading up to the convention. I must have had about 40 Zoom calls where that sort of replaced the convention format. And then most nights I have anywhere from 2 to 5 Zoom calls replacing normal meetings. I will say it's interesting. People are attending those meetings. So not the same, obviously, as in person, certainly harder to generate energy and enthusiasm. But what I will say is when we do have meetings on Zoom, they tend to be longer. We're not having to do that 10 or 15 minutes in and out because we have to get to a new place where there's drive time. But we're getting much deeper questions and people really listening and trying to grasp what it is the court does and how this process works, because let's face it, Michigan is unique how it does it. So we are still reaching people, but it's just electronic and having to do a lot more digital outreach.
Jack?
Yeah. Is it a little, I guess what the word might be, I don't want to use the word depressing, but troubling for someone who's running for a position like this when they start telling you you don't have a name that is going to be as easily just identified by voters, even though it's the name you've had your whole life, and that may actually end up being a bigger problem than no matter what you say or do.
There is no doubt that this race is one that we've seen people with certain last names, you know, and this isn't unique to Michigan. There's sort of this history and kind of the East Coast and upper Midwest of certain names prevailing in judicial races because voters often don't know who to vote for. So they guess. Obviously, we would like to take the guesswork out of that. So you are correct. That can be frustrating. We are hopeful that people, maybe with more people voting absentee, this could be a silver lining. People will not feel that pressure of the voting booth. And I've done election protection work for, you know, since 2004. So I've actually seen that in action when you're observing polls, people feeling that pressure to vote and not knowing what to do. And they flip that ballot over. And I think a lot of times don't know who people are. So they vote for familiar names. That is absolutely correct. That's a phenomenon. I'm hopeful that with absentee ballot voting, people will be sitting maybe at their kitchen table and taking a little more time to research the candidates and maybe being a little more thoughtful who they're voting for. But yes, that is obviously the phenomenon you're talking about is probably not the best way to vote for any candidate, but it's very common in judicial races.
What about just playing name ID in terms of there's not massive amounts of money that usually go into these races, so you can't even get your name out there with a jingle on it or something that makes people remember it. Can you even attempt to be creative, I guess, at all with this thing?
I mean, yeah, we actually are trying. I mean, I think every person running for this will say that they are doing the best they can to push their name ID out there. It's a big state. Obviously, we, you know, do it just like every other race. You know, we've got yard signs and all different strategies to try to get our name out there. There's no question name ID matters a lot in these races. So we are working on that. You know, I guess we'll find out in November if we break through. But we're hoping we can do it. I'm running alongside the Chief Justice. Chief Justice McCormick has done a terrific job. We are really working together on this race and hoping that that will help sort of break through some of the noise, because it's a noisy election year. There's no doubt about that.
Do you think we'd be better off if these weren't elected positions? And you can apply that question almost all the way down the judiciary.
Yeah, it's a great debate. It's such a it's one of those things you can make arguments both ways, right? And this is one that the state has to decide what it wants. We have this unique blend, just as a way of background. Michigan has the political parties nominate the Supreme Court candidates, and then we run nonpartisan. So it is a bit of a strange hybrid. So that's just the Supreme Court. Judges all just get signatures. All the rest of the judges on the ballot just get signatures and run strictly nonpartisan. So the state Supreme Court is unique in that the parties sort of adopt the candidates that they have nominated and help sort of push out information on those candidates. You know, I can make arguments both ways. I think the state Supreme Court process is pretty unique. It is a nonpartisan race, and politics should not play into any decision making. And obviously, we want integrity in the process. And given there's a political element to this, people could question that. And that's obviously, we don't want that. So you would hope the justices get there and do their job well. I think we have a high functioning court right now where people are really trying to take the politics out of it and make decisions based on being a good justice. There are certainly arguments that can go the other way, that if it's appointed, you might get people that, are sort of political loyalists, and that's how you get the appointment. So it would depend on what the appointment process is, I think. I think there are solutions to that where you have independent commissions and different groups who vet for that process to sort of strip the political nature of the process out. Because I think, there's benefits both ways and there's downsides both ways. I think you're on to something, though, that when you have an electorate that often doesn't know who the folks are and is guessing, that's certainly not ideal. The counter to that would be, at least, you know, they're elected and accountable to the public. And in democracy, that's always a good thing. But if people aren't paying attention, then that would be an argument certainly for another avenue. And states have gone different ways on this all over the country.
But you obviously can't run for the office saying you're against voters picking somebody.
No, I mean, I'm not. I actually, I believe that my goal is just for voters to be informed. And that's, I think, one of the challenges with these races that Jack's getting at, is just that if they're guessing, is that the best way for people to select judges? And the hope is voters aren't guessing. And like I said, I'm very hopeful with more people voting absentee. You know, obviously a lot of people this year because of the public health crisis, but even moving forward because of Proposal 3, I think more people will be. I think it's going to become part of our DNA more. And I'm hopeful that that will help people be more informed on these races.
So I had a question. From the Republican convention, they nominated their people, calling them rule of law judges. Would you consider yourself a rule of law justice if you were to be elected?
Yeah, it's sort of interesting. I, yes, I will follow the law. You know, that phrase rule of law has obviously become a brand for conservative judges. That's no secret. But certainly I will be following the law, which also includes the Constitution, and ensuring that everybody has equal and fair access to the courts. So I will be following the law.
So, but
rule of law has sort of become branded.
Right.
As a certain type of judge, I would say I am not cut in the mold of Antonin Scalia. I am not, and that's probably not a secret to those who know me. But I, of course, will uphold the law.
So who would you more look up to then? If not Scalia, then who? Ginsburg, John Paul Stevens? I mean, who?
I think Ruth Bader Ginsburg has done a phenomenal job. I think she writes brilliant opinions and brilliant dissents. So she provides a roadmap on important legal issues. She was also, prior to getting the bench, a brilliant attorney. A lot of her cases involve strategy, and she implemented well and frankly changed the law of the nation on many issues. So I would say she is definitely someone I look up to.
All right. So I got to ask, Welch, is that an Irish name? Scottish? What is that?
It's English.
Okay.
And it's actually by adoption. My grandfather was adopted by a family. His name was Cornelius, so it would be Dutch. So I'm from West Michigan. A lot of people are Dutch. So I indeed am part Dutch, but part English. And yes, and now, so Welch is an English name.
Not Irish. So you can't even claim you've got even like a little bit of Irish.
There might be some in here. I mean, we're all kind of mutts, so there might be some mixed in, but not that I know of.
Well, and that just kind of goes back, and we're going to kind of close on this point, though, about the Irish name and how that's been really a big deal. Now, are you going to say anything at all during the campaign, or maybe you let the party do this, that the Mary Kelly who is on the ballot is not the Mary Kelly who has been... who has won the bench before, that this is a different Mary Kelly.
Yeah, and there was a Marilyn Kelly before, right?
Right, yeah.
So who the Democrats nominated. And then Mary Beth Kelly, who the Republicans nominated, who is also running for the Wayne County Circuit Bench now. So there will be a Mary Kelly running for the Supreme Court and a Mary Beth Kelly running in Wayne County. So it's obviously confusing to voters. People ask me all the time, what's the lay of the land? I explain to them, this is a crowded ballot. There will likely be seven names because the Libertarians have put forward a couple, the Green Party won, the Republicans too, and the Democrats too. So it's busy. So I do explain who's on the ballot and their backgrounds. And yes, I have explained to people that it is a different Mary Kelly. But it's not something I spend a lot of time on. People do ask, and of course I answer the question if asked.
All right. Any closing thoughts here then before we let you go?
Yes, thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to you. The biggest thing is we just need voters to pay attention to this race. As I said, 95% of cases are filed in state courts. The Supreme Court makes really, really big, important decisions on issues like, gerrymandering, the final say on the Independent Redistricting Commission and that outcome. If you look at other states that have implemented similar protocols for drawing political lines, those usually end up at the Supreme Court. It all impacts our lives.
All right, Elizabeth Welch, she is the Democratic nominated candidate for the state Supreme Court. Thank you so much for being on our podcast today.
Thanks a lot for having me.
With no more king.
We're going to elect a president.
No more king.
He's going to do what the people want.
All right, joining us now for the podcast is the spokesperson for Unlock Michigan, the petition initiative that is going on right now, the attempt to have the legislature repeal the 1945 Riot Act, as we refer to it. His name is Fred Zolick. Thanks for joining us on the podcast, Fred.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so give our listeners a little bit of an update on where you guys are at. We reported in MERS recently that you guys are at 300,000 signatures already collected. What time frame is that, and when are you estimating that you're going to be able to get the signatures you need?
That's pretty darn quick. We collected the first 100,000 in 3 weeks. We got the second 100,000 in 2 weeks, and this third 100,000 came in 10 days. So we're not slowing down. We're speeding up. You know, we're a little bit weather dependent, so we're reluctant to make any predictions because, you know, the Michigan's unofficial state slogan is, you know, wait for the weather to change. We just don't know, you know, what the next couple of weeks are going to look like. If we continue to have, you know, fantastic weather out there for people to do the circulating work and then to actually come do the signing, then we'll wrap up really quickly. If we get, you know, a spate of mediocre weather, maybe not as quickly, but we'll get it done fast one way or the other.
So one of the things that I was skeptical about this initiative is, first of all, getting the signatures, which it seems like you guys are doing an extremely good job doing. And why don't we stay there before I get to my other concern? Why has this been so successful? I mean, to get 300,000 signatures as quickly as you have, obviously it looks like you're going to get to 400,000 here in a matter of time. Why is that? Why has this been successful when we have had no gatherings, we've had no football games, we have no baseball games, we have had none of the events that you would traditionally get these signatures at?
Yeah, I mean, the mechanics of it have been pretty interesting. It's instead of going to Pine Knob or going to the Tiger Stadium at prefabricated events, we're just creating our own. And our folks are able to do that with Facebook and other, you know, their own networks. They're pretty entrepreneurial. They know how to network in their communities, and they're just really committed. They'll set up a table at a rest stop or a post office or in the farmer's market, and their friends and neighbors are coming by and signing. It's all happening very, very quickly. But we have to give credit where credit is due. I mean, the governor keeps bolts of lightning of enthusiasm are going through our grassroots networks because of the things she's saying and doing. And, you know, to claim that she is being bullied, poor Gretchen Whitmer, that she's being bullied is these business owners beg for their own survival, you know, reminds people why we're doing this, that we have one politician has taken on unlimited, unending role of life or death over every aspect of life and culture in Michigan. That's why we're doing this, because no person ever gave a politician unlimited power forever until they decided they were done with it. Because spoiler alert, duh, they're never going to be done with it. They will always have an excuse for why it needs to go on longer. But then, you know, she's been attacking us continuously. She draws attention to our movement. The UAW helped too. I mean, you can't leave them out, that they sent out an email to all of their members saying how terrible we were. And then we suddenly started seeing lots of UAW jackets walking up to our signing events wherever we went in the state. So the other side has been, you know, giving us an assist, and we appreciate that a great deal.
So the realistic way this could play out, we talked about a little bit with, okay, you get the signatures, you turn the thing in, and gee, we got an election coming up, and gee, we've got a pandemic, and maybe the Secretary of State gets around to taking a good look at these signatures maybe next April. Is that unrealistic?
It's unreasonable. I don't know if it's unrealistic in the new normal that we're in. Terrible idea on their part. I mean, I you know, look, they don't have to validate 500,000 signatures. They have to validate a sample of 500 signatures. And even state employees can do that work rapidly. In the olden days, they would have to package this up in 500 envelopes and mail it to the township clerk. And they would go through their card file and try to find that person. And that's how they validated it. Today, somebody can sit at their laptop with the QVF and validate this stuff in an afternoon. So no excuses. No reason to wait until next April, pandemic or no pandemic. The Bureau of Elections could get this work done very rapidly, and we could vote on this year. They may choose not to, and maybe they think having this on the ballot in 2022 next to Gretchen Whitmer's reelection is a good idea. Awesome.
Well, but I mean, you got to be a little concerned about this, because the Right to Life people did their dismemberment, what they called their dismemberment petition. They turned it into the Secretary of State's office 3 days after Christmas, and then they didn't get information back on their signatures until what, May or June? I mean, I know we had the pandemic hitting right at that time, but to Jack's point, I mean, they could say anything's still going on. We still got the pandemic. We still got a general election that's extremely busy, I'm sure, for them. There could be a reason why they want to wait until maybe January, when maybe the Democrats have a majority or get a 55-55 split, to lock up the House. And, you know, that could be a scenario that you're operating under.
It could. But if we can collect 500,000 signatures this quickly, they can validate 500 of them that quickly. I mean, if they want to get this done, they can. If they want to slow walk it, then I suppose they might try to do that. But again, they have to face the reality that our initiative might end up on the ballot alongside Governor Whitmer's reelection. And then we can spend an entire 2 years talking about her handling of this crisis. Without any oversight, without any involvement from other elected officials, she decided to put the most contagious people in Michigan alongside the most vulnerable people of Michigan in nursing homes. And we can have that debate for 2 full years.
If the Democrats do take majority and this does get pulled over into 2021, then the alternative is that it goes on the ballot in 2022. And that would give, that gives you a talking point for that election. I hadn't considered that.
If I were Gretchen Whitmer's campaign manager, I think I would want to rip the Band-Aid off a little sooner. But hey, you do you.
It seems like the state legislative caucuses, the GOP caucus members, are really, really active in that. Is that the case? And who stands out really as a sort of putting in the Herculean effort?
Boy, you know, it's hard to choose one over the other. I think, you know, probably the first were Senators Nesbitt and Barrett. They, you know, kind of got out there publicly. A lot of state representatives are out there actively collecting. And, you know, it's a tool that's available to anyone. I mean, you know, they're having, you know, what amounts to little miniature festivals over a couple hour period in local parks and farmers markets and in every corner of the state. And then, you know, we see it on Facebook and, you know, we're advertising some of these events. We're driving traffic to them, which is nice. So we're kind of having to rewrite the playbook of how you do petition gathering. But there's something unique to this issue because, you know what, the fair and equal people are out there on the streets with petitions too, and they don't seem to be operating at the same speed and they have the same tools available to them. So there's an energy to what we're doing that they don't seem to have. And at some point, maybe we'll sit down and chit chat with each other and figure out what it is. But our activists want to get this done rapidly and they want to, you know, we could get back to adulting pretty soon, right? I mean, like Michigan is an outlier in so many ways. There are 46 states that the gyms are open. What is so special about Michigan that we can't open gyms? The governor won't tell us. It's a secret. She has science that only she knows about that says Michigan has to be one of four states in the union where it's too dangerous to open gyms. The other 46 states are safe, but she has her own secret science that says no. In the meantime, there's people having to pay rent on their gyms every month, and they have no memberships because their gyms are closed. So it's a life and death decision she's making over thousands of local businesses, and nobody gets any input. There's no route to appeal. The judiciary shrugs and says, well, I guess the legislature meant to do that in 1945. So the only recourse these people have is this petition, and that's powering the movement. Mm.
Right, and just not the gyms either. I mean, you've got movie theaters and gymnastic studios and ice rinks. And I guess also if you're a high school football fan, this gives you another outlet.
It does. And, you know, I think a lot of us are at this stage where we think adulting begins, where I could walk into a gym and say, you know what, that looks pretty sketchy. It looks dangerous. I'm going to walk back out. It's too dangerous for me in this gym or this restaurant or this ice rink. Or I could say, you know what, I feel like I'm pretty healthy today. I'm going to wear my mask and go in. We could all do that. And we could give these businesses a fighting chance to stay alive. If we don't, I mean, the risks are pretty damaging. Many small businesses, you know, have a lease that they've had to personally guarantee. So they're not just risking their business, they're risking their home and their credit rating. And of course, if they default, then the owner of the property is going to have a hard time paying their bank loans. And then we're going to be looking at bank bail. I mean, this really can spiral out of control if we don't get back to something that looks like normal sometime relatively soon.
I think this has been something that's been confounding people. Theoretically, it's the older population that's a little bit more, obviously more at risk with the pandemic, but the thought is they're a little bit less in a hurry to get out of the wearing the mask to get back to normal because, you know, naturally they have more concerns about it. Theoretically, people 40 and under are more likely to say, hey, wait a minute, my chances of something bad happening to me is, you know, not particularly high. Would you say that the people that have signed these on average are younger than the normal population, older, or a mix? Is there any way you can tell?
I could probably give you an answer to that in a week if I did a little digging, but not off the top of my head. I don't know. We're having a lot stronger support for this outstate. One of the things that the governor did to really provide a lot of momentum to us was, you know, just before the holiday weekends, she decided to shut down Northern Michigan and the Upper Peninsula. And so it was, you know, kind of like this wacky number. She decided if your restaurant or bar gets 70% of its revenue from alcohol, then you're dangerous and need to close. If you get 69%, then you're safe and you're good. That's real science there. It kind of seems like normal government sausage making, but she deemed it science. But these guys have a season that lasts, what, like 10 weeks? And if they have to spend 9 of those weeks closed, they're dead. And so we've got this, she's got these regions that don't make any sense. I mean, Livingston and Lapeer and Livernois Avenue all start with L, but they have nothing in common, right? But they're all lumped into one emergency region for purposes of her policy. The standard, the goalposts move every couple of weeks. At the time she shut down all the bars in the Upper Peninsula, there were 0 cases of COVID-related illness in hospitals in the Upper Peninsula. The curve does not get flatter than 0. And the goal was supposed to be flattening the curve. And so if you're a business owner, you think it's smooth sailing. There aren't any hospital cases in the Upper Peninsula at the time. And then you're blindsided and you're closed and you're done for the season. You have no hope. You can't stay alive for an entire year, you know, without a summer season in the Upper Peninsula. And so people are confused by this. And so young and old, it may have more to do with the fact that your economic future is being just completely wiped out. You yourself may choose to stay home and play it safe, but you want your communities to stay alive. That, I think, has a lot to do with the sentiment in a lot of the regions of the state.
Could it be argued that these events that you guys are having, your Unlock Michigan petition events, are also potentially dangerous and that you could be spreading COVID-19 by handling pens and keeping together? I mean, Tom Barrett, who was a leader in your Unlock Michigan, still is, did get COVID-19. We don't know where. He could have got it from one of these signing events.
Apparently, the contract tracers have been pretty hard at work on that question. And I'll tell you this, if they had figured a way to blame us for this, they would have by now. It seems like the best science is that very little of this virus is transmitted in outdoor events like this, where people are coming and going and passing. Now, if you're all sitting in a circle breathing at each other at close quarters for an hour, maybe that'll be different. But I don't think these signing events present much risk. No more risk than, you know, the 600-person National Guard event the governor held in Grayling. No more risk than the Milliken funeral, which happened in Traverse City. No more risk than these protests that are going on throughout the state at different times. We don't seem to be seeing these outdoor events turning into super spreader events the way some indoor events tend to be. So we've stuck outside for most of these things, and luckily we've had a nice summer.
Where's the funding for this coming from?
Oh, almost knocking on the door, 2,000 individual donations online. You know, thousands of people are responding to emails as we go. Lots of businesses are contributing. You see a lot of gym owners, a lot of bowling alleys, you know, a lot of folks who've been victims of this reign of error are responding and they want a fighting chance.
Also, a big bulk of your funding, though, is also coming from a group whose funding we have no idea where it's coming from. And Bob LeBrant, a former Chamber of Commerce executive who's always been a friend of Republican causes, has actually filed a complaint because he wants to know where this Michigan Citizens for Fiscal Responsibility is getting their money from. What do you think of what he's doing?
The First Amendment still applies. That whole freedom of association thing that Bob was defending there for 45 years is still in effect. The governor has not declared that to be invalid during this emergency. You know, I mean, people are contributing to a number of different vehicles and they're contributing to us. I'm not in charge of any of that. I know that my ballot question committee is running according to the law. We do our disclosure when we're supposed to. You know, we itemize as we're required. It's all being done according to state law. And if somebody thinks the state law is wrong, then that's a whole different argument. That doesn't have anything to do with what I'm doing right now.
But should Citizens for Fiscal Responsibility form their own campaign committee, their own ballot question committee, so we can see who is contributing to them, who are contributing to you?
Bob's got this unique theory that if an organization contributes to you once, then that's great. If they contribute to you twice, then it's some conspiracy and there's a presumption that you're doing something illegal. And there's no basis for that in the law. I think some of my funders are supporting me based on benchmarks. You know, like they're crazy people. They decided not to give me all the money up front. Some of them decided, you know what, we're going to give you cash as you achieve different benchmarks. So maybe you get some to start, and then you get some at 100,000. That seems perfectly legitimate to me. Bob created this entire other legal theory out of whole cloth that is completely made up. There's literally no mention of that in the law anywhere or in any interpretive opinion that's ever come out of the Secretary of State's office. And he doesn't get to invent his own laws for 501c4s.
And then another one other thing I wanted to bring up. There was some controversy about one of your circulators that he's had some a sketchy background in complying with the law in the past. What's been your response to that?
Go figure that a couple of these people who are in the petition gathering business are a little sketchy. The guy who we work with, Lee Albright, is one of the pros in the business. He's been sort of really good at trying to keep the bad actors out. There's another guy that was sort of obliquely referenced in the Free Press story who has this record of like coming to town, getting paid, and then not paying any of his circulators. Is actually working for the Fair and Equal campaign, not us. We drummed him out the minute they sniffed out that he was in the state. Apparently, he goes in and then creates a whole bunch of new LLCs that nobody's ever heard of and tries to get hired, and then he like takes the money. We're policing this as best we can. Most of our signatures are going to come from the 60,000 grassroots activists who are doing this stuff on weekends, you know, and they're wearing funny hats and they're collecting their signatures under banners that say end Whitmer's endless shutdown. We're not hiding what we're doing at all. We've got about 100 guys out collecting signatures at post offices and stuff, but we can't police every one of their interactions with every person. We do know that they sign a contract with us that say, I got your talking points and I promise to stick to them. And if they're not doing that, we just get rid of them because, look, we don't need to misrepresent what we're doing. If you can't get people to sign this petition by telling them what it does, then you're a moron, and we just don't have a lot of room for morons.
All right, Fred Zolick, he is the spokesperson for Unlocked Michigan. Appreciate you being on the podcast.
Take care.
All right, you too. All right, that's going to do it for this week's edition of the Murderers Monday podcast. Thanks to Jack and John and Sam Singh, Elizabeth Welsh, and Fred Zolick. And so, guys, since we can't do Dalmac this year, I'm going to go ahead and just do my own bike ride. I'm going to check out for a few days, and I'm going to just bike up north to Mackinac City and just bike until there's no more land to bike.
You can always come to Drummond Island.
Yeah, but, you know, they won't let me bike across the Mackinac Bridge anymore. That's the problem.
Forgot about that.
You know, a few years ago I was able to, but maybe I can put it in the back of somebody's truck and they can wheel me across.
There you go. Well, make sure you ride safe.
All right. Well, thanks. And Jack, what are you doing now that there's no college football?
My new sport that I watch, I have the one sport that I could watch going back to the 60s because I did not actually know who won. The point of watching college football from the past where everything kind of loses its interest when you already know who's going to win. But I have now watched every televised Masters golf tournament going back to 1965. And it is like watching it for the first time because I did not know who was going to win. I also have the Augusta golf course almost memorized in terms of the holes, which is kind of neat.
So are you watching old World Series yet?
I will do my plug. The 1968 World Series was a fantastic World Series, whether you're a Tiger fan or not. Underrated. And I don't know how many people know this. You can watch all seven games on YouTube.
And you speak with experience.
World Series.
And you speak with experience on that.
Oh, yes. I came home. I had study hall. That day that the Tigers won the seventh game, I got to leave early and walk home from school, came into the door just as the commercial was ending to begin the seventh inning, which was the inning the Tigers finally got to Bob Gibson, scored the three runs, and won the World Series. So I have I can tell you who batted everything else. So yeah, that's fondly remembered. But again, you're biased because you're a Tiger. What I'm saying about this now is this was actually a great World Series regardless of whether you were a Tiger fan or a Dodgers fan or anything else. It was just an outstanding World Series.
Well, let's not get it too ahead of ourselves, but you know, the Tigers are 500 right now, and with the expanded playoffs, and if their young pitchers can get it together, who knows? This could be one for the ages. Maybe not as great as the 68 World Series, but memorable nonetheless. Thank you, Jack. Thank you, John. Thank you, AT&T, for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts. Until next week, I'm Kyle Malin. Take care.